Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm just in.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Mornings with Carmen here on the 3rd of May. By the sound of my voice, I'm obviously not Carmen LaBurge.
Obviously.
I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner filling in this morning as Carmen has a well-deserved break on a Friday morning. But glad to be in studio with you, Paul Perreault, as always. Good to see you again.
And good,
you know,
to see you.
So often you and I cover some weather news here and there, but it's pretty benign weather out there. In fact, it might actually threaten to have some sunshine today, from what I understand.
Oh, terrible. Yeah. At least here in the Twin Cities, we're looking at 60s, 70s tomorrow, and pretty much all our stations that I was doing the weather for looking pretty nice over the next few days.
Yeah, it's so good. I know that I can struggle a little bit with that seasonal affective disorder, but I'm starting to find that I'm having daily affective disorder. Just to miss the sun for a day seems like it kind of clouds my judgment on a number of different levels. So it's going to be good to have the sun out. Great to be with all of you this morning.
They do listening. Have lamps that help with that.
Well, I might have to look into that here during the break. But love being here. Love being back in the studio chair with all of you. I think often about what a pleasure it is to have all of you listening from different states and different denominations, different church backgrounds, as we gather together in a common place like this in the morning, fixing our eyes on Jesus together, living out life in the world. And thinking about that last night, thinking about the show this morning, there's a verse from Hebrews that came to mind because we certainly cover a lot of difficult news. Our topics here on Mornings with Carmen, and I'm sure in your life you are running into things that are troubling and hard to process at times, and that certainly is a life that was consistent with the first century church, and especially those to whom the book of Hebrews was written, as they were struggling with their faith, wondering if it was worth it, starting to walk away from the faith, and into that difficult reality, the author of Hebrews, who does remain unknown to us yet this day, wrote this beautiful invitation about how we can consider spurring one another on toward love and good deeds. And he goes on to write in verses 24 and 25 of the 10th chapter that we should not forget or give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but instead gathering together to encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. And it's with that spirit in mind, the idea of all of us from different walks of life, again, different parts of our country, even around our world, but all fixing our eyes on Jesus together, that we gather this morning to go through some of the headlines of the day, some of the topics that relate to us as believers as well, walking out life in this world. And we've got a great show ahead to do just that. We'll talk in a minute with Matthew Hawkins, who is the former policy director of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, about a couple of the key headlines from this past week, including one that really had my attention, and two different realities from one from Alabama and one from Kansas, in which some laws were passed about the abortion reality in our country. And looking forward to getting into that with Matthew. And in the second half of hour one, my dear friend Gary Stratton, who teaches courses on worldview and leadership at Johnson University, will join us. And Gary and I are going to talk about the challenges of being an authentic servant leader. So welcome to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and we'll be back in a moment with Matthew Hawkins. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner filling in this morning for good friend Carmen LaBurge, and delighted to be joined by Matthew Hawkins this morning, who's a former policy director from the Ethics and Liberty Religious Liberty Commission. And Matthew, do I understand correctly, you are working on your doctorate in public theology? I think you and I have talked about that before, actually.
That is correct. I'm on the front end, so just whittling away and pursuing that. We need some better models for local church engagement of politics, and that's kind of where I want to center my attention.
I just had a student ask me in class yesterday, Matthew. She said, "So should we be out and standing on the front steps of maybe some of the congressional halls in our state, or maybe going to Washington D.C. and taking a stance mm-hmm. on some of these issues of the day, including abortion that we're going to talk about here in just a minute?" But that was her question. She said, "Does it really make a difference to try to bend the arc of legislation, or should we be focusing on something different?"
Well, in the American context, I keep coming back to the basics, frankly. We need to be more involved at the local and state level. That stuff trickles up. The presidential elections and national politics tend to capture our attention. It looks bigger. It often moves much more slowly, more like an aircraft carrier. But you would actually be surprised. Representatives at the national level in Congress, they're fairly responsive to your outreach if you are a voter in their district. That's what they care about. So I'm not going to call up a senator as a citizen now in Tennessee. I'm not going to call up a senator's office from Maine to express my opinion because they frankly don't really care. But I can reach out to my Tennessee state representatives, and they're more sensitive than you would than you might be aware of, and particularly local district offices. DC gets all the attention, but often local district offices don't get as much attention, so they're a little more sensitive to local folks who reach out and want to meet with them. You can do that. There are about 11 or 12 weeks out of the congressional year that members are back in their home districts. That's a really great time to schedule a coffee or go by the office and meet them. And you'd be surprised how receptive they are. And it's literally their job to meet with you and hear what you do. Politics is all about relationship, Peter, as you know. And so I encourage people, the marching stuff, the protesting stuff, that I think has waning influence presently. But if you can build a relationship with some folks, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it sounds like politicians can be relatively receptive. I mean, I think there's some politicians that sort of suck all the oxygen out of the headlines, and we assume all politicians function in the same way. But I know there was a caller on the Bill Arnold show yesterday afternoon who said she had just gotten back from sort of this political day of prayer down at Minnesota State Capitol and talked about the fact there's really good people in politics. It isn't all the sort of the trashy back and forth that we sometimes see in the headlines, is it?
Exactly. It's not usually that terrible on the inside. And frankly, there are a lot more Christians who are involved in various corners of the government locally and in the federal government that are doing their best to work within their conscience to do the right thing. And so you only find those people by being engaged and meeting people and, just doing some basic networking. And all of a sudden you discover Christians who are working in some fairly dark corners. That was one of the things that struck me when I was in D.C. is how many Christians there are doing their best to influence policy where they can.
Mm-hmm. Well, shifting to some of the headlines of this past week, some of them that caught my attention, Matthew, included some of the legislation coming out of Kansas and what historically has been a pretty staunch anti-abortion state. There's been a pretty seismic shift coming out of Kansas. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's a real disappointment. You're right. Kansas is a Midwestern country, Midwestern state. Maybe it should be in its own country. That's a Texas thing. you're right. A lot. It seems to be a right of center kind of place. But in recently, as you mentioned, the state Supreme Court struck down an anti-abortion law, essentially codifying in this respect to the state constitution that abortion is a right. That's pretty tragic. But big picture is, I think last time when I was on with Carmen, we talked about the heartbeat legislation, or one of the last times we talked about the heartbeat bills that are popping up. So you look at the political spectrum of abortion politics. You have some states pushing these heartbeat bills and the pain capable bans, and you have other states like this who are on the left side trying to codify abortion protections. The scene for this is setting up a Supreme Court battle, I think, is ultimately where we're probably headed. This, if you need to underscore why judicial appointments are important, the Kansas situation draws that pretty starkly.
Yeah, and on the flip side of it, I saw some news coming out of Alabama in which the Alabama legislature voted 6-1 for really restrictive abortion rights, and really only in the case of the mother's life being in danger. And that is another one, Matthew, that seems to be setting up for a battle to go to the Supreme Court. So you see on Kansas on one side, and on the flip side, you see a very different state taking a very different tact.
Yeah.
And in light of that, do we see the possibility that if the Supreme Court was to strike down Roe versus Wade at some point, that it would maybe go to the states to decide about their own abortion policy? And if that was the case, I mean, you could really see some pretty significant fissures in our country on this.
That's correct. The landscape following a Supreme Court ruling undoing Roe v. Wade would kick it back to the states, in which case you would have literally a mosaic of laws across the 50 states about what abortion policy is. Some states have been proactive, and they have drawn a blank on which ones, but some states have some proactive legislation that, in the event that that should occur, they kind of know what their plan is. My theory on a Roe v. Wade kind of challenge is that from the Roberts Court, we haven't really seen sea change legislation that changes aside from the gay marriage ruling. We really haven't seen kind of some kind of big culture shifting, law changing kinds of things that would flip things on its head on any particular topic. So what I suspect would happen was you could get a series of abortion conflicts in the states, and a Roberts Court would try to do a very narrow tailoring. So it would kind of chip away, I think, at the foundation of what Roe v. Wade rests on. So I think we would expect probably meager progress, but progress nonetheless. I just don't anticipate from this court Roe v. Wade being completely undone in one decision.
Yeah, certainly the people that were so anti-Justice Kavanaugh and people so pro-Justice Kavanaugh last fall during that appointment proceeding, this is really the reason why, is that we're maybe headed down that road. But to your point, it probably would be a pretty slow walk to any kind of change in legislation. Well, we'll take a short break here, Matthew. When we come back, I'd love to change the topic to some of the rise of anti-Semitism, which is a pretty new development, at least in the 48 years that I've been on this earth. Certainly anti-Jewish realities have been part of the situation, but it really is on the rise. So I want to get your take on that next year on Mornings with Carmen. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, filling in for Carmen LeBurge and having an interesting conversation with Matthew Hawkins this morning. And Matt, I have been following a little bit the rise of anti-Semitism and even just sort of the religious conflict that seems to be getting more and more hardened with each passing week. And I'm not easily disturbed by events in the world, but I have to say these mosque shootings and now the synagogue shootings, I mean, these are places where people are terribly vulnerable. And boy, it really is troubling to watch what is motivating these shootings. The shootings themselves are awful, but it's that religious conflict underpinning it. Boy, from a historical standpoint, that never ends well.
Oh my goodness! The houses of worship shootings are just unbelievably horrific. I mean, we've seen it in churches here in the States. It clearly happens around the world. We saw the catastrophic terrorism in Sri Lanka attacking Christians at Easter worship, and in California we have another synagogue shooting with one dead and one heroic now deceased Jewish lady who jumped in front of a rabbi once the shooting began. And I think a 9-year-old Israeli girl who was injured, and her family had moved here from Israel about 8 years ago for a more peaceful and safe life. And it's just unbelievably tragic. Anti-Semitism, of course, is a millennia old kind of bigotry and hatred. It's as old as biblical history. We see it in the Old Testament. We see it we see it in the New Testament. And sadly, we've seen a rise of it in recent years and months. I first wrote a draft article, I think back in 2013 when I was with the ERLC, because there was a rise of it in Europe. And I was trying to call attention to it. Attention and other issues came up. We never published it. And then in 2016, again, there was enough anti-Semitic chatter in the States that I revised it and we published it. And then just recently, this week, I published a revision making four observations of anti-Semitism. First of all, we need to kind of know what it is. It's hard to pin a definition to the wall that is accepted globally. But the Department of State uses this working definition. It's a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as a hatred towards Jews, rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and their property, toward the Jewish community, institutions, and religious facilities. So it's this weird mix of ethnic or racist hatred combined with a religious hatred. And it starts with rumors and chatter and conspiracy theories and ends up in violence. The other observation is anti-Semitism is anti-Bible for two reasons. Number one, among others, loving one's neighbor is the obvious one. But we're all created in God's image. That includes Jewish people. So anything, any kind of worldview that dehumanizes a particular human being, whether it's racism or anti-Semitism, that's anti-Bible. It's also contrary to, as we Baptists put in our Baptist faith and message, God's gift of freedom of thought and religion. If we're oppressing people because of what they believe spiritually, that's anti-Bible. And anti-Semitism breeds intolerance, more intolerance against others. So where we see anti-Semitism left unchecked and really not reined in, more intolerance towards other minorities follows. And church history, lastly, shows us we were wrong. There's an account from Baptist historians that shows Southern Baptists visited Germany in the 1930s and returned to America with glowing reports about what was going there, even though anti-Semitism was widely visible. They met in Germany under swastikas. So this is something that our own Christian denominations can fall prey to if we're not careful. And the recent rise of it is just so horrific.
Yeah, the article you referenced on those 4 points, Matthew, of course, is available on the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission website at erlc.com. And it's that final point, Matthew, that I'd love to get into a little bit more deeply, because it really was surprising to me. I didn't know until a couple of years ago how complicit the church was in Germany in terms of fueling the rise of Hitler, that they really sort [S2] Right. [S1] Of stood aside and, in fact, even embraced some of the policies because they felt it was a way to keep their social power. And so how do we avoid [S2] Exactly. [S1] The sort of mistakes of history?
Well, I think we need to be not caught up in political power, number one. I think that's one of the ways that the Germany church fell, was that Hitler really intentionally, my understanding, is cultivated and kind of inoculated the church, the state, the national church at the time, with power and access and all that kind of stuff. I think we need to be really clear that our view of the world needs to be rooted in our identity within Christ's kingdom. And the local church is an outpost, something of an embassy of Christ's kingdom in the world. And that ought to direct our allegiances first and foremost. So while we want to work within current politics and shape them from time to time, and frankly, that requires developing relationships and allies, we always need to not forget our first loyalty, and that's to the kingdom of Christ, and where even our friends and allies, or even our political parties, or even our kind of social tribes tend to trend in a negative direction or away from a Bible ethic, we need to reorder and focus our attention on what it means to be part of Christ's kingdom. And part of that is loving our neighbors and loving our enemies. But look, the Jews are not our enemies. Let's get that straight.
Yeah, that's such an important topic. And I think for another time, Matthew, I'd love to get into that with you. I have about a minute left or so, but there's obvious disagreement on Jesus being the Messiah between the Jews and the Christians.
Sure.
And yet at the same time, that doesn't give any reason for any kind of anti-Semitism.
Exactly. We need to look at all non-believers as potential future believers, future siblings in the kingdom of Christ. We all come from a starting point of being dead in our sins and needing our Savior, Jesus Christ. And so we need to think about other people in our other communities and our own families, even if they express a different religious attitude or choice right now and different beliefs. They could be one day a future sibling, and we need to treat them as such and seek to attract them to the Christian faith, not push them away.
Well, great to speak with you again, Matthew. Good luck and continued luck on your PhD. I remember that feeling. If I could just even bang out one page in an evening while I watched SportsCenter, I felt like I had climbed Everest.
Thanks, Peter.
Have a great day. We'll take a short break for lighting up here and some bottom-of-the-hour news headlines. And when we come back in the second half of this hour, we'll be joined by Gary Stratton, and we'll talk a bit about servant leadership. Well, for those of us that are Scrabble lovers, and I've played Scrabble ever since I was a boy, it's one of my favorite memories, thinking about playing Scrabble with my father growing up. Some pretty big news in that there are some new words coming out officially available for you hardcore Scrabble players. 28 new words, and included are words like fleek, which, Paul Perreault, I don't even know what fleek
means. I know nothing of fleek.
F-L-E-E-K, which is a pretty good word to be able to use that 5-point K character when you get it. It's always, you know, tough to find one on that. We've got Yowza.
Yowza.
And then we have another one that is kind of interesting and descriptive of where we are as a country, where we are with what is becoming more and more mainstream. Certainly, these are the conversations I'm having in church these days, and that is gender queer. And now, it's a pretty long word.
Long word.
Yeah, if you were to use that, you would obviously have to build off of the word gender or queer. But what an interesting time, because it's not just that. There's a new two-letter word, which is zay or z. It's a new gender-neutral pronoun that could be used. This is actually gives us an opportunity to talk with our kids, if we're going to play Scrabble, about words that are becoming mainstream that maybe a generation ago it didn't even exist.
Yeah, and I just think of the point totals you can get with the Q's and the Z's on this whole thing.
Well, it's really true. So for you Scrabble players, my favorite style of board is the one with the raised edges to keep those letters in place, because there's nothing worse than getting to the end of a Scrabble game and accidentally bumping that board and sending everything sprawling all over. So look forward
to the
new...
You've done that intentionally, though, when you were losing.
Yeah, but I would never admit that. And most often I am losing, so most often that does indeed happen. So for you Scrabble players, pick up that new dictionary. Some pretty interesting words in that. And up next year on Mornings with Carmen, we'll be joined by Dr. Gary Stratton. And Gary and I are going to talk a bit about servant leadership and the challenges of becoming a servant in a kind of environment in which we're so invited to promote our own sense and our own gain, build our own resumes. How do you serve in the midst of that?
Scripture allows only one kind of boasting. This is Jim Garlow. In Jeremiah 9:23, the Lord says, "Let not a wise man boast of his wisdom. Let not a mighty man boast of his might. And let not a rich man boast of his riches." When you think about it, since this life is temporary, wisdom, strength, and wealth all fade away. But God does not. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's why verse 24 continues, "But let him who boasts boast of this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises loving kindness, justice, righteousness on this earth, for I delight in these things." So boasting is a good biblical thing when it's done for the Lord. You're not to be holier than thou. Rather, you glorify God for His grace and His mercy and invite others to join in. There's more at wellverse.world.
Dr. Gary Stratton, for the rest of my life, when I hear that song come on the radio, I will be thinking with great affection of you, our friendship, and the fact that that song represents your journey with the Trinity. I love the idea that you have had to quiet your voices in your head and in life and just dance with the Trinitarian God. It's such a profound thought.
Well, it's when I get out of that thought that I get in trouble. So it's great to be with you, Peter.
Yeah, it's always fun. And I have to ask you, sort of before we get into some of the conversation on servant leadership, when I was driving home from my class late last night, teaching through some of the New Testament course, I caught on the news and I actually gasped out loud when I heard the news. And you're somebody who worked in Hollywood for the better part of 7 years. You've been on the inside of that scene. And I was greeted with the news when I got in the car that Peter Mayhew, who is the actor, 7'3" actor who played the beloved Chewbacca, passed away yesterday. And I literally gasped out loud when that happened. I mean, it speaks to sort of just how familiar and how important some of these characters are in so many of our lives.
No, it really is. We've just been slowly but surely losing all these cultural icons, Alec Guinness and Carrie Fisher, and now Peter Mayhew. So I'm sure he didn't actually make the Chewbacca noise. I heard that was like mixed from whales and walruses or something. But boy, talk about a beloved character.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Gary, just in our public consciousness, now that we have the rise of the internet and people sort of with their own personal YouTube channels, that we really don't have the same kind of impact coming out of Hollywood in terms of these cultural icons that you reference, because there's not a collective consciousness that is all directed towards maybe one movie or one song or one situation. I remember growing up, we lined up around the theaters and the entire country was wondering whether or not Vader really was Luke's father. And there was this social consciousness, this collective consciousness consciousness that we shared as a country. And it seems like we've lost some things in the sense that we've individualized almost everything as people are sort of doing their own thing.
Yes, that is true. Things are so incredibly niched. I used to be able to literally predict 20 of the, if there's 30 students in my class and I ask them to name their favorite films, I literally could predict 20 of the 30 that were going to be named. Not anymore. Sometimes I miss all of them.
Well, and with that too, and I know we're going to talk about servant leadership, that actually transitions into that. And, you know, Gary, I've been thinking quite a bit over the past month and a half, and been talking about this in churches as we're raising our kids, and so much of the confusion, not just in the gender and sexuality conversations, but just in life in general. Where do I fit? Where do I belong? And is some of the issue here that one of the primary mantras or slogans of our individualistically based culture really is that we tell our kids, you can be whatever you want to be. And I think there's some important intuitions in that statement, but there's a little bit of a subtle and maybe dark downside to just telling our kids all the time, hey, look, it's your life. You can be whatever you want to be.
Well, it's probably more an extension of our American dream gone haywire. Anyone can pull themselves up by the bootstraps philosophy, which is there's some really wonderful things to that, that when it gets Christianized, it's kind of scary to worship a savior who was obsessed. You could say his entire life was a statement in, I think this is Henry Nouwen's words, in downward mobility. And we live in a culture that's so focused on upward mobility. So when we tell our child, you can be whatever you be, you can do whatever you want to do, what they either hear from us or what we're subtly communicating to them is, well, what matters is that you're rich and famous and powerful, even if it's Christian power, you're well known, really? Is that really what Jesus, who gave up godhood to come and be a servant and die on the cross for us, is that really what he models for us?
Yeah, I would love for you to say more just about what you just said, and I haven't heard it framed that way, and it's compelling to me about this idea that we are so focused on upward mobility that we sort of think that the next rung on the ladder is what's going to bring in the satisfaction that our soul desires, and yet the invitation within the Christian kingdom is this invitation of downward mobility. Gary, do you have a you've worked in spiritual formation and cultural conversations forever, and do you have a sense of what sort of drives this illusory pursuit in upward mobility that God, gosh, if we can just get to that situation, we're finally going to be happy?
Well, I think on the one hand, it's just a very human thing. We just always think some next thing's going to fill the God-shaped hole in our heart. And unfortunately, we keep doing that even once we come to faith. We keep turning to other idols as God's kind of dealing with those and helping us look at things differently. But this way of radical service, this way of taking the lowest seat, not just accepting it when it's offered to us, but actually accepting it, of throwing parties for people who can't pay you back, for a savior who was willing to live a completely radically different life than anything that we would ever imagine a hero of the faith would be today. Today, our heroes of the faith are the ones that we watch on TV or read their books, or they build big churches, or they're on the radio. And that's kind of the standard Christian success to do with it. I mean, I teach a couple classes in our Christian ministry program here, and I taught the head of the Christian ministry program at Bethel. And there's this obsession, they're just obsessed going into ministry, young men and women. If I just do my quiet time and keep my nose clean, then I too can be, a famous megachurch pastor, as if that's the goal, as if that's the gold standard. And I think as long as we keep doing that, we're going to keep people attracted to those things, not out of godly ambition, and we're going to keep seeing them, their inner life fall apart and embarrass themselves and the body of Christ by them not being able to maintain a moral lifestyle in the midst of those struggles.
And as part of the way in which we move from upward mobility to downward mobility, does it sometimes take some sort of pretty extreme event to sort of burst the bubble in our lives? I think about Gary when I was in my late 20s, and we knew each other even back then, and I was speaking in a church with 5,000-6,000 people and sort of identified as a next megachurch pastor. And really, it's really you kind of get drunk with the power of it all on some level, and you don't admit it when you're in church ministry, but there really is that dimension of it. And it took getting very sick and, in fact, having a temporarily but very difficult terminal diagnosis to sort of burst that bubble and get me off the ladder. Is that what you've seen so often, that we might want to start a life of downward mobility, but it almost always takes a significant bubble-bursting moment to really start that descent?
Well, unfortunately, yes. I mean, I do think historically there probably are two or three ways that people can get there. I mean, I think being part of a community that's devoted to a genuine life of prayer, I think people can get there that way, because there's just a sacrifice and service and a not turning to yourself for everything that can happen in that kind of community. And of course, radical service. Someone who's really given themselves over to service to the poor or getting the gospel to places where it's never been before. I mean, sometimes by starting the journey, people can get there, but normally it's suffering. I mean, it's just the way that we're wired, that until we're whapped really hard across our consciousness, we really don't pay attention to the more important things in life.
Yeah, we were talking through in my class last night about that beautiful verse from John 3:16 about God so loving the world that he sent his son, whoever believes will not perish. And we were really digging into that passage. Both the word belief is within it, not this idea of intellectual assent, but it's an idea of a surrender of the soul on an ongoing basis. And the word perish there isn't necessarily a synonym for hell. It's the idea that you're walking on pathways that are futile and failing and don't have a permanent future to them. And I think that's part of this, isn't it, Gary, that how many pathways do we walk in this life, whether it's a pathway pursuing vocation or a relationship or some other reality, that ultimately to get a sense that those pathways will indeed perish. I think about John Singleton, the director of Boys in the Hood, who made such an impact on our social consciousness, passing away this last week. And my students don't remember his name at all. He did leave a legacy behind, but the next generation doesn't even remember who he is.
No, and I mean, there are certainly people who write or create a work of art that influences culture for the long term. But for the most part, it's the people that we've interacted with personally that is the legacy that we're going to leave. I mean, I look at students all the time when they say things that, okay, why don't you tell me the name of all of your great grandparents? And they don't even have the foggiest idea who their great grandparents are. And so that's how quickly someone who's incredibly important to them is lost to history. So what matters is, are we giving ourselves to our neighbor, to the people we encounter? Are we loving them selflessly? We're more focused on the downward mobility of serving others than we are in kind of building our own little kingdom. And it's a very anti-Western, democratic, American dream way of looking at the world, but it is the way Jesus looks at the world.
Well, I'd love to get into that next. We'll take a short break, Gary, and talk about if you're going to start this life of downward mobility, whether you are a teacher, a doctor, a lawyer, a parent, however you're walking out life as you're listening this morning, what are some steps into a place of descent where we begin to serve in the kingdom? So more coming up next here with Dr. Gary Stratton. Whatever you do, just don't look back. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner in the host chair this morning as Carmen has a well-deserved break. And we are chatting with Dr. Gary Stratton about downward mobility and servant leadership within Jesus's kingdom. And Gary, as we've been talking about and contrasting the idea of be whatever you want to be with the idea that in the biblical text, we're actually bondservants to the king. If we really try to play out this be whatever we want to be mantra, at the end of the day, we realize you actually can't, because Gary, I would love to be an astronaut, but I hate parabolas, and so I have no shot at ever being an astronaut. And so, you know, it's a silly example, but I think we all could say the reality is there are many things that we will never be, and it's really a false statement, isn't it?
No, it is, and it's actually setting up an idolatry that there is something that's more valuable than pleasing the Lord and living in a place of loving relationship with Him and the people around Him. That for some reason right now, our culture right now is very obsessed with fame. There's some horrible survey I just saw that 40% of 15-year-olds in America are convinced that they're going to be famous someday. Doesn't leave a lot of room for anything else to happen in the world.
Wow, yeah.
And it's because, yeah, somehow, you know, fame is the most important thing. Ironically, the people who have achieved fame We accept for the very small percentage that we see kind of deliberately keep themselves in the public eye. Most of them work really hard to stay out because it's such a horrible thing to be famous. So the very thing we're craving is actually robbing people of happiness, and yet we still crave it because it makes us feel good about ourselves.
Yeah, it does. And you talked about that God-shaped hole, is that we can try to fill it with other things and other substitutions, and you can live an entire life of what you've described as upward mobility, and you get to the end of it and see that sort of in those words of Solomon, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And so how would you counsel somebody, Gary, listening this morning? Maybe it's a teacher working on their master's degree and for very good reason, or it's a parent thinking about some next step with their kids and how to help build their resume, or maybe it's a different profession, whatever it is, how do you begin sort of a life of downward mobility in the midst of an upward mobility culture?
Well, I think part of it is just following Jesus. I found this great quote, very influential book by Henry Nouwen called The Selfless Way of Christ, which is where I got the phrase, the downward mobility from. But it's just a paragraph, but let me read it, where he says, the story of our salvation stands radically over and against the philosophy of upward mobility. In the center of our faith stands the Christian mystery that God chose to reveal the divine mystery in unreserved submission to the downward pull. God not only chose an insignificant people to carry the word of salvation through the centuries, not only chose a small remnant of those people to fulfill God's promises, not only chose a humble girl in an unknown town in Galilee to become the temple of the word of God, but God also chose to manifest the fullness of divine love in a man who lived a life that led to a humiliating death outside the walls of the city.
That is it's a profound statement, Gary. That idea of who Jesus was and how he walked out his life, we do love to say Jesus is Lord, and he really is Lord, Gary. But boy, there's a whole other dimension to this, and that is the descent into a suffering servant. In the words of Philippians, to have this very disposition in you where you take on this servant heart. But that's what lasts in the kingdom, right? That the rippling effects of our service begin to bring life and hope and peace empowered by the Spirit into other people's lives. And that's what really continues to shine the light.
No, I completely agree. So, to get to there is something else altogether. But, Jesus, asked some very basic things. He said, just develop a habit of taking a lower seat or the lowest seat. And they were obsessed in their culture with getting the highest seat at a banquet. And that means different things in our culture. But just when we walk into situations, we just automatically start navigating to try to get in that seat of honor. And just deliberately not to do that. Just deliberately start being a servant, taking the lowest seat, doing things. Jesus said, of course, the good thing there is you might get invited up to a higher seat. But just developing that habit, serving people who can't pay you back. We had a group of students over here the other night, actually last night, they had no hope of paying us back. And so that was kind of the beauty of it. The night before we had some good friends over, but we're getting lots out of that. Can I give myself and time away there? Can I devote myself for a season to praying really hard for someone that's there? If they're blessed, it doesn't bless me in any way. You start analyzing your prayer life and realizing, well, first 90% of it's probably focused on me. And then it's on me and my kids and my job and my friends and my, to say, well, am I actually giving myself away, even in a prayer life, even for a short period of time? And then to encourage our kids to choose places and ourselves to choose places of service. I'm amazed that, and I'm just going to say this in just the right way, or I'm going to get myself in trouble, but I'll say, the bottom third, prestige-wise, of the Christian colleges in America produce two-thirds of all the missionaries that go to the world in the church today.
Wow. I have never heard that stat before, Gary. That is an actual physical representation of becoming less in order to become sort of great in the kingdom, as it were, by an entirely different economic metric.
Yeah, well, there's just some tendency that by choosing a school because it's prestigious, because of what the sticker looks like on the back of the Volvo, or because, whatever reason, just automatically creates a culture that's about upward mobility. And if you just look at the magazines of these schools, it's all about people who have succeeded and all about people that are famous and all about people that have written. Those are all good, but the very subtle tendency is to start to ignore all the people, vast majority of people, who are giving themselves away to the poor, to the lost, to the sick. And I think that's more where Jesus would be. And so I don't think it's surprising that kind of the less prestigious schools end up producing downward mobility better than the prestigious schools do.
Well, and Gary, we just have a little bit less than a minute left on this, too. And it's never too late to start a life of servant and leadership, is it? I mean, I think about people who maybe just retired and wonder, gosh, did I lose my entire sense of identity? I no longer have that vocation. But you can enter into a life of service at any point in life.
Yeah, there's unbelievable needs for volunteers, unbelievable needs for people who are willing to work at minimum wage to do amazing works, especially in our urban settings and among the poor, give our expertise away to schools and to mission groups. I mean, those are the places where life and vitality comes. And I know that's definitely been true in my life. And I've really only been the last 5 or 6 years I've gotten very intentional about seeking downward mobility. And I'm the happiest I've ever been.
I love it. Well, Gary, it's always great to hear your voice. Look forward to the next time we have a chance to chat.
All right. Thanks so much, Peter. Good luck.
Take a short break here and wrap up our first hour and preview what's coming up on hour two here with Mornings with Carmen. I always appreciate the chance to chat with Gary like that. He just brings such wisdom and perspective into our Christian journey. And start at the top of this hour by reading that great passage in Hebrews from the 10th chapter, verses 24 and 25, about spurring one another on towards love and good deeds and not giving up the habit of meeting together, but encouraging one another. And I hope as you listen to Gary this morning that you felt encouraged to just keep walking out this journey of downward mobility, to pick up our cross again yet today, and to live a life of service with other people. He's so helpful in so many different levels. Well, looking forward to here into hour two on Mornings with Carmen. We're going to be joined first by Adam Holtz of PluggedIn.com. Got to ask Adam a little bit about the death of Chewbacca, as well as some reflections on the Avengers movie that came out last week. So lots coming up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.